Hello, and welcome to Special Ed Rising, No Parent Left Behind. I'm your host, Mark Ingracia, and I've been an active member in the field of special education for 35 years as a classroom teacher, tutor, parent trainer, consultant, and advocate. Thank you so much for joining me. In this episode, I'll be speaking with April Rehrig. April is the founder of Rise Educational Advocacy and Consulting, LLC. She spent over 20 years as an elementary school teacher and school psychologist in Los Angeles before starting Rise. April is a licensed educational psychologist, LEP, and board-certified special education advocate, BCEA fellow. She attended the prestigious Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, COPAA, SEAT, S-E-A-T 2.0 and 3.0 programs. April is a certified Autism Spectrum Disorder Clinical Specialist and Master IEP Coach. RISE provides parent advocacy and IEP coaching, 504 guides, and do-it-yourself IEP kits. Follow April on Instagram for weekly IEP tips and stories from the heart. And when not passionately advocating, you'll find April walking her hilarious pug. This is a podcast for parents and caregivers of children along the spectrum of disabilities as an information hub and promoter for the advancement of people with disabilities in all areas of life. So if you're interested in learning about topics from the world of exceptional needs, educational services, health and wellness, fitness, nutrition for you and your child, and more, this is the place for you. If you like the show, please subscribe, like, comment, and tell your friends about it. And for some extra help to inform your journey, visit the resource page of my website, specialedrising.com. I would love to feature your success stories on the show, so if you'd like to contribute, please send them to my email so we can show the world what's possible. If you enjoy the podcast, now you can tune into my YouTube channel, Special Ed Rising, for short clips from my interviews. The catalog is growing, so look for new clips in the coming days and weeks. Now, let's wend our way through the IEP weeds on our way to another win. Hello, April. Welcome. How are you?
I am very good. And yourself, Mark?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for joining us today. IEP season is now, and a lot of parents are working through the process, and you are a perfect person to come and talk to about this. So I'm looking forward to speaking with you and having people find out more about you and what you do.
Thanks.
So to start us off, can you share something like a fun fact about yourself, something that might be different from your job?
Yeah. So a fun fact about me is that my husband and I have 7 kids between us. So I have 3 boys, and then he has 2 and 2. So between us, we make the Brady Bunch.
Wow. That must be fun, huh?
Yeah. It's just, you know, when you have a lot of kids, there's just a lot of stuff involved. So it makes family get-togethers really awesome.
I see the sign Rise behind you, and I think it's interesting that we both have Rise in our titles. How did yours come about, your title?
I came about for the name of my business because I really feel like that I wanted to work on transforming the process for parents and teachers. And I felt like the word that described it best would be RISE. And I wanted something positive and interactive and inclusive. And the name RISE just came to mind.
That's really great. Not the way it came to me, but for a lot of the same reasons or the same symbolism. Yeah, mine was a transition in life, and I kept hearing Bruce Springsteen's song, The Rising. Literally, within 5 minutes, I heard the song Rising. I saw someone walk down the street with a bag that said Rise on it, and then it happened another coincidental time. So I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to be using here, because it's very positive, like you said, and it's hopeful and inclusive, I feel, you know. As far as your background, it's quite expansive. So maybe you could give us a little bit about it.
Yeah. So how I came to the position where I am today is kind of a journey. And just like many of your listeners, whether you're a teacher or a parent or a provider, it usually for special education doesn't just happen. It's sort of, you kind of merge and get into there. So I always was in education. I grew up in a family of educators. And I always was in a classroom, so it felt only natural that I'd become a teacher. And before I was a teacher, when I was a teenager, I did a lot of volunteering, and I volunteered in a special education school. And I fell in love, and I knew this was my place. But when I became a teacher, I wasn't really familiar with special education. They didn't really talk about it during my teacher program other than here's a class. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll just be a teacher. And being a new teacher, I had several kids in my class. Many of your teachers will find this hilarious, but it's true. As a first-year teacher, they tend to give you the most difficult kids, the kids that all the other teachers, when they do the scheduling, doesn't want. So I had 14 boys and 4 girls and all the kids who struggled. And I referred many of those kids by first year to get special education testing because I assumed, like many teachers do, if they aren't learning, it's because they have a disability. And what I found at all the eligibility meetings is a majority of the kids were not eligible for an IEP because either A, there was something else going on, or B, they were gifted or twice exceptional and I wasn't providing the right instruction. So it checked my expectations at the door, made me pause and made me realize I need to become a school psychologist. So I became a school psychologist for about 20 years and I worked in a lot of different school districts. During that time, I found the special education journey difficult, frustrating, and run really ineffectively. And being a mom at the IEP table, I also found the process deficit-based and problematic and not inclusionary. So I decided that I wanted to do things differently. So as a school psychologist, I would work with families across the aisle to try to make things more inclusive and work on strength-based assessments and working on having better IEP meetings. One of the biggest struggles that teams have is that because they're not communicating and they're not really making the process understandable to families, families get frustrated, they feel like they're communicating, and then the trust is broken, and then this leads to due process and frustrating, difficult challenges. And so after 20 years, I decided to leave the profession and do what I always had loved, but I didn't really know that I was an advocate. So when I formulated RISE, I wanted to bridge the gap between parents and teachers. And I really felt like the only way to do that is to reach across the aisle and work on the process. And to improve the process, we need to better communicate and work as more of a cohesive team at the table. And so this is what I do at RISE, is to work with everybody on the team, whether you're a teacher or parent, to empower parents and make the process more understandable and more productive.
Yeah, it's so important because I think there's a lot of assumptions made, or just not even assumptions, just not even considerations of parents. Just the process is here. This is what we're going to do. You show up, tell us if you like it or not, and we'll move along. You know, sign it and we're on our way. And then parents are also not even encouraged to follow up with the process and how things are going. It's a much needed thing to have. I noticed going back, I want to talk about what you do at RISE as far as, you know, you're kind of a full service IEP stop for everyone, it seems. You have this new program, it seems, on your website. I saw the special education cycle. Is that basically kind of inclusive of the entire process as you were just speaking about?
So when I talk about the special education cycle, it's not a program. It refers to the journey of special education. Most teachers and parents, even as a school psychologist, we always thought of the journey as linear. You start in general education, the end is special education, when actually that's not the case. When it comes to special education, in order to start at child find and end up with an IEP, if you think about it, you have an annual IEP, a second annual IEP, a triennial, or perhaps a supplemental assessment. It actually repeats itself. So it's a cycle. And the reason why I teach it to my families and teachers is that if things aren't going well, you need to adjust where you are. But the biggest challenge for many families is navigating, where am I at now? If things aren't going well, how can I change my trajectory by changing where I am in the process and understanding where I need to go? And so that's why I reframe special education from a linear, a place, to a cycle and an ability to adjust yourself on where you are and where you want to go.
And I think that visually for parents to even conceptualize that, it makes more sense, Right. Linear, it almost feels like you could just kind of fall off the table at some point. Here, you're constantly part of the process, and it's a great, great visual. So maybe you could talk about some of the services that you provide at Rise.
Yeah. So when I formulated Rise, it was right after the pandemic started. So everyone was virtual. And I felt like many special education advocates, we tend to be in person. And so we'll work in maybe one or two school districts. We have our set people, we stay in our lane. And my whole philosophy, like I said from the beginning, is that I work across the aisle with teachers. And I really felt like so many teachers, and this was me as well, is that we don't have the right training for IEPs. Many of your listeners will probably say they got a class or they get an attorney telling them what not to do. I can't think of a single time during my 20 years as a school psychologist that I got training on how to write IEPs and any training on how to connect my reports to the IEP. And so that's why I feel like teachers are hungry. They want to work with families, but they aren't given the right tools. And so I decided, okay, I need to write my own curriculum about how to write IEPs and then to make it understandable so that anybody could learn it. Because the reality is, teachers and parents make the best advocates once they have the tools and the strategies in order to get there. So my curriculum is sort of a do-it-yourself online program. I have four courses targeting the four areas where we struggle the most: how to request testing, IEP meetings, understanding reports, and parent participation. So once those four core areas are met, then all of a sudden that IEP cycle starts to flow again because we can target the areas where people struggle the most.
Right. And then you build their knowledge so they're stronger during that cycle.
Yeah, correct. And in most families, like I said, they know something's wrong, they don't know where to start, they want to start, but they don't know how, or they're in it and they're stuck. And those are the areas that we really want to target the most.
And they're probably the most common things. I mean, because it's, you're not experienced, you're not practiced going into this world. It's brand new to you. And I find that with special education, there are a lot of assumptions and a lot of things that are left out. Even as kids grow and through the high school years and transition, a lot of parents are ignorant of the process because they're not being taught or informed about things. And so they don't know necessarily. All of a sudden, they realize their child's 17 years old and they're about to leave school. And like, oh no, what are we going to do now? The system, and of course, some schools are probably better at it than others, but there is that lack of communication. And so when you have a child and they're newly diagnosed, where do you turn? How do you even know where to go? I feel like someone like you getting the word out, I mean, I feel like by doing this kind of thing, there's more available to people than ever before as far as information. And so, can you speak to that a little bit as far as like the history of that?
I feel like nowadays, especially with social media, that there's an overload of information. And fortunately or unfortunately, there's many places where parents go. Facebook groups is one, where parents go there and they speak to other parents. And just like if you're a new parent and you have a child, everyone is giving advice. Everyone's telling you what to do. And as a parent, just like when you take your child to the doctor and they're sick, you know in your heart something is wrong and that the doctor might be like, oh, don't worry about it. That's part of growing up. Just because they're not talking, you need to wait and see. When in reality, parents know something is off and you really need to learn to trust yourself. And the only way to really find the information is to educate yourself through high quality and quality materials that you can find instead of a Facebook group or a friend, which is wonderful, but that's not the place to get the quality information. And so, with the overload that's out there, you need to train yourself on really trusting your gut and looking for quality places that have the information instead of just a friend for understanding things and the complexities of special education.
Right. I mean, the support is wonderful and that's great. But you're right. I mean, I've known parents to listen to every person that's in their life, family member, teacher, whatever it is, they start to go in one direction. Somebody gives them another piece of advice, they move in another direction. And before you know it, they're completely just, they're lost, they're overwhelmed, and it's a very, very challenging situation for them. So you went from being a teacher to a psychologist to your job. How do you find that the integration of all those things has helped you to be a better advocate for families?
Because I feel like when you write the IEP, it takes a team, like we've been talking about. So I found as a school psychologist, when we would be working on writing the IEP, many school psychologists who didn't have teacher training would struggle to understand what is the functional academics or what is the, you know, expectations at a fourth grade level. And so having that teaching background gave me the perspective of, okay, this is what we're really learning at this level. This is what this curriculum looked like, or this is what the standards are expected for that grade. As a parent, I felt like giving me the perspective meant everything. So when I was delivering information at the table and speaking to kids or speaking to parents, I was speaking from a mom. I was speaking from, instead of putting on my hat as being a psychologist, here's the reality of parenting. And then I felt like as an advocate role, I blend all of those with the experience of, just like if you're a parent and you speak to another friend who has a new baby and you have an 18-year-old, you have a lot of different paths that you've lived. And so you're able to kind of reframe the different perspectives easier. So having all those different roles, I feel like, has made it easier for me to see those different points of view from each side.
Yeah, I think it gives you more a nice advantage there to be able to kind of like bring everything together, especially being a teacher too. You know, I think parents, you know, that's the next in line, right? From the parent to the teacher. So you want to be able to have that trust and that understanding. And I think that, you know, having been a teacher myself, you know, I think there are some parents that are able to be more involved than other parents. And you, as a teacher, you can be biased towards a family because of the way their child shows up to school, or the lack of communication, or the over communication, or whatever it is, you know. And I think that's important for teachers to realize that that's every parent, just like every child, is an individual, and you have to take them in that regard and approach them that way and understand that everybody, no matter where they're coming from, is important and deserves the best you've got. And it's a natural human thing to kind of let down in some cases, I think, too. So for teachers, you know, being educated about the IEP, I'm trying to remember back when I was getting my master's, how much time was really focused on creating an IEP. I don't even remember if there was. And so you enter the program, you enter the job, and all of a sudden you're asked to do this. And that's quite a responsibility. Do you have any advice for teachers coming in that maybe don't have that experience, how to be able to prepare themselves better for maybe coming into the job?
Yeah, so I definitely recommend for new teachers to come into the job to look at quality resources and websites. For example, IDEAs that work, Ideas That Work is a great website. There's many other state and national websites that I highly recommend. For teachers, they can't join, but for your parents, you can join COPA, which is the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates. And it's a wonderful, high quality nonprofit. Understood.org has a great different articles that are easy to read and very clear on the process. And honestly, just looking up information and taking the time to look at what it means on your state website. So I'm in California, so I started looking on the California website for eligibility code, federal laws, state laws, and I'm not an attorney, but I spent a few months looking through it so I could really understand, okay, this is what I've heard for years as a school psychologist, this term, here's what it really means. And that's how I really formulated my curriculum, is by doing my own research and then putting it together in a sensible way, so that I felt like I got the information from the source.
Is your curriculum something that could be possibly used in colleges? Is it an endeavor of yours to get it out there?
Yes. So I do have some guides for college-bound students. I have a how to take your IEP to college guide. And it's a fillable guide, and it's very simple to use. And so it has worksheets, it has fillable templates, and it basically shows teachers and parents, since I worked at a high school my last 10 years, of how to transition your disability services from high school with an IEP or 504 to accessing disability supports in college. because that's one of the biggest areas, Mark, when I worked in the high schools, we struggled with. They'd come to do junior and senior IEP, and the parents were like, okay, this is awesome. What do I do?
Yeah.
And all we would say is, well, you go to the disability center. And they're like, but what does that mean? And we were like, I don't know.
I don't know, right?
We had to be honest. And so we'd sit there, and finally I was like, you know what? This has been 10 years I've been doing this. I need to figure it out. And I found out all these things I had no idea. And so I give this talk a lot about taking your IEP to college. So that's definitely one of the services I provide, Mark, because parents spend years trying to get an IEP, and then their child goes to college and they don't access the services. So
that's wonderful. It's so needed. It's funny how you say it took 10 years, you know, and it's true. It's like you've got blinders on. You're kind of just figuring it out year to year to year, you know, and then later on, it's like, ooh, wait a second, you know, and then you talk to people. Being more in the world of parenting at this point now, working with parents more than actual, you know, classrooms with children, you find out all the struggles that these parents are going through and the things that they don't know. The schools just don't prepare them. The system doesn't prepare them. It's really, really, it's an embarrassment, really. I think it's very sad. And I'm so grateful that someone out there like you is helping people to do this stuff. Can you talk about some of the do's and don'ts of the IEP process for parents, maybe just to kind of save them some time in the process?
Yeah. So the number one thing I tell parents, and I used to hear about this from advocates, but I didn't quite understand, is you always want to put your concerns in writing. And so how this looks like for a parent is that if your child has an IEP and you're talking to the teacher all the time, what's going on in the classroom? My child's having meltdowns, or something is wrong here. I need help. Talking to them or sending them an email, it might not get translated and it doesn't go into the IEP. So the best way that you can advocate for your child is to get everything that you need on the actual IEP document. But the only way to do that is to change how you communicate. So I teach my families and I teach teachers how to write what's called a parent letter of attachment, which is where they're attaching their concerns or what they're asking for in an educational record. So it's either attaching it to the meeting notice, attaching it to the IEP, attaching it to maybe the psychologist report. And then it's telling the team, here's what I'm concerned about, here's what I want, and here's what I would like you to do about it. And what's awesome about communicating that way is it goes into the child's record, but more importantly, the school finds out, here's exactly what they want to talk about. And so we're going to address this at the meeting. And so it's a different way of understanding the information. And I also teach parents how to write a parent report. And I feel like that is a huge barrier. So many times when we come to the IEP process, parents, for example, depending on your state, they have a parent concern section on the IEP. It's probably like this. And empowering parents to write a report, like a special education assessment or something else, it doesn't have to be complex. You don't have to have a teaching credential. But as a parent, you can talk about, here's all the outside tutoring I'm doing. Here's how my child is doing at home. I want you, school, to see all of the documents and all the data that I have and put this in the present levels. Then when it comes to formulating the IEP, formulating the goals, all of a sudden the school has, wow, mom's been doing all this outside therapy. This is really helpful. So I really understand how to address counseling. Or wow, the parent's been talking about what a struggle it is with transitions. This is something we're going to embed into the goals. So I feel like empowering parents, giving them the words and the communication, it helps things more transparent. It saves time from hours and hours spent on emails and endless phone calls, and also helps the teachers, because then the teachers are like, oh, here's what we work about. Instead of coming to the meeting and after half an hour, the parent's crying and they're like, this and this happened. The school was like, we had no idea.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's such a great practice. It's so important. I think that it does speed up the actual IEP meeting too, probably, because, you know, you get to the point, you get to the facts much faster. What I've always been saddened by at meetings, and it still does, because I still have some students that I work with and attend meetings, and how quickly the parents are willing to just kind of like, you know, accept. Some might have a couple of questions here and there, but there's not a real back and forth disclosure like you were talking about what's going on at home. And I think parents get a little burnt because they feel like they've tried stuff and they give up on the process, in the sense, to the degree that they're going to push harder. Plus, I know parents that are afraid to push because they don't want to get a bad reputation, and then they feel like there's going to be retaliation against them. Have you actually gone to, as an advocate, through the legal process with parents that perhaps weren't treated well at these meetings? Have you had that kind of experience?
Yeah, so I have. I've been to many meetings where the school will say, well, wait a second, the parent, you can't ask questions, or here's, this happened to me thousands of times. And I even saw it as a school psychologist, where the parent shows up and they're like, here's what we're offering, you need to sign. And I would have to back up the team and say, actually, this is part of a team process. The parent can ask questions, and the parent actually has a right to talk about and make proposals. And I say, well, that's not what we do here. Or they would have a meeting and they would have an interpreter. And I know a little bit of Spanish, but not too much. And I would see that the interpreter was coaching the parent by saying, you need to do this, or this is what it is. And they weren't saying things for word. So I'd have to stop the meeting and say, actually, this is not what we talked about. Can we get someone else to the meeting? Because this interpreter is telling something that the other person's not saying. So all of a sudden, the parent was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. But they felt so embarrassed, and they felt frustrated because they were trusting what the other person was saying was the exact word for word, because why would you question someone who said, I'm listening to you? So yes, I have found that happen. And again, it goes back to the training piece. And I really feel like many things in schools, and this happened to me as a school psychologist, we're told, this is how you do it. And we're not given the right training to understand this is the actual process. And so it's not necessarily nefarious what many schools do. It's just they get into their zone. This is how we do meetings. This is what FAPE means. This is what parent participation looks like. And until we're told otherwise, why would we do it differently? Just like a parent, you know? And so again, it goes back to that training of really understanding the process and working on more the quality of the service and working on reframing the process to back to the consumer. And parents and students are the consumer when it comes to IEPs.
Absolutely. And knowing, you know, having that knowledge, knowing when to question something that you obviously don't recognize as what should be, their rights being taken from them, being able to speak up in those moments, being educated. And that is lacking. You know, I recently did a podcast on 504 versus an IEP. And just getting the process rolling, I think, is something, as you mentioned earlier, parents just don't know what to do. So do you have any advice for parents in getting the ball rolling for themselves and initiating the process, requesting an evaluation and things like that?
Yeah, so I do. I definitely work with families on that and have a guide actually for that, because I felt like that's one of the biggest misunderstandings when it comes to the difference between an IEP and a 504 plan. And 504s have so many robust supports and actually have a lot more checks and balances in place than IEPs. But many teams aren't really familiar with a 504 process. So when I was a school psychologist, we'd sit in on many 504s and they would look to me as the expert. And then when I actually started doing my own research, Mark, and finding out what a 504 really looks at, I was like, wow, I didn't get the right training. So 504s, I definitely would suggest for parents and teachers to look at OCR and to look at the regulations to understand how to get a 504 and what it looks like. And one of the biggest differences that I feel like parents in school struggle with is understanding 504s are a great support for students that either have or are suspected of having disability, but perhaps they need adjustments or accommodations, versus an IEP, they might need services. And when it comes to getting a 504 and IEP, you can actually have services for both. You can have transportation for both, and they both involve FAPE. However, IEPs have goals, specially designed instruction, and they have checks and balances in place in terms of options for parents and things like that, versus a 504 is more of an academic adjustment. So So again, it goes back to getting your procedural safeguards, because when you request for a 504, you're supposed to get procedural safeguards, understanding the difference between them, and then doing your own research. So whether you are asking for a 504 or an IEP, really looking at what does it look like before you start down that path.
Being educated in the 504 is really important. Can you talk about maybe some of the accommodations and services that are available through a 504?
Yeah, and I'm glad you said accommodations and services that are available, because a lot of times parents are told, and I got told this too as being a school psychologist, well, you can offer only these accommodations from this checklist, or you can't get services if you have a 504. And the truth is you can actually have a 504 and an IEP at the same time. And many people don't know that. However, most parents, when they're given that choice, we'll pick the IEP because there's more robust supports and due process involved. But when it comes to a 504 plan, once you qualify for a 504 plan, it's really based on the assessment findings. And so going through a 504 process, it is an assessment, but it's not an assessment like what we think of when it's special education testing or formal testing. But the plan itself is supposed to be crafted based on need. So if you're a parent requesting a 504, you need to approach it the same way as an IEP. You write a robust letter. Here's what I'm concerned about. Here's what I would like supports in. And then the plan has the same involvement in parenting in terms of just the same as an IEP. So deciding on the accommodations, deciding on the supports, perhaps services or perhaps transportation, goes back to the present levels of performance and the assessment, whether it's the report card or so forth. It really needs to be individualized based on the child's strengths, not just their deficits, and really what they need. So for example, I had a 504 plan for a child who had a temporary disability, but it ended up being long-term. My last couple of years as being a school psychologist, they had a brain injury, and they were twice exceptional, but they would have to be absent sometimes for weeks at a time to go to the hospital to get these procedures. So we decided that a 504 would be the most appropriate. So when the child was absent, they had an ability to be able to make up the work, come half day at school. If they couldn't walk that day, they would have access to the elevator, have priority scheduling, get out 5 minutes early so that they could walk the campus without being bumped into because there was health issues. So those kind of accommodations we put in the plans, and actually modifications, and you can get modifications with the 504 plan. And then the child was able to access the curriculum and graduate high school like everybody else.
That's wonderful. I feel like that the process for parents can be elusive. And when it comes to understanding the reports and the testing, how do you prepare parents to understand the testing and the results and be able to read them and know what they actually mean? Do you do that? Is that part of your service?
Yeah, that's one of the trainings that I provide, or to do it yourself, is understanding reports. And I absolutely agree. Understanding what the report says means everything. And one of the challenges and the problems that we really experience, and I experienced this as being a school psychologist, is that we're trained to write reports that are not meant for parents. We're told to write reports that have legalese and need to say all the rules. If you look at the regulations for IDA, they don't say you need to write the reports that say the law. They say that you need to write reports that are clear, understandable, and make sense. But we're told to write reports not for the parent and the child who's a consumer. And so I wrote very long, lengthy reports because I was told the more you do the testing, the more you write, this is the test and here's the test scores, and the less I focus on the child, the better the report is. And that's the farthest from the truth, but that's the way we were trained. So I decided to change my report style and work on functional academics and work on what is the actual performance conditions. And when I write a recommendation, to focus on writing actual recommendations, and it's okay to write recommendations, and that what I say in the assessment is really supposed to connect with the IEP. So if I talk about the child is struggling perhaps with executive functioning in my report, then we as a team are like, okay, what are the setups that's needed for Mark when we're going to work on executive functioning? How do we connect that and embed that into the IEP itself? But again, it goes back to the training and the understanding of what does a report really do? And what does an IEP really do? And how do we kind of connect the two? And that's where the reform comes into place. It's like, we need to do things better. We need to do things differently that are easier and make more sense.
Yeah, it's almost like trying to keep information from parents, by the way, writing it the way they tell you to write it in the legalese, you know? So you're kind of a rebel, basically, you know?
Yeah, I'm kind of different. Many school psychologists get kind of scared because they're like, wait, you're a school psychologist and you're saying you don't have to write really difficult reports. And I say, actually, you're sitting there because that's what we would do. We'd spend 40 hours writing a report. And then they literally, thank you so much, April, for your report. They set it down. And they write the IEP. And that's how I did it for 20 years. And I was like, something's off.
Yeah. I'm surprised you haven't had a lot of people jump onto your side of your aisle. A lot of psychologists.
No, I have had. I have a lot of school psychologists take the training because they're like, I'm tired of writing. Or I have a lot of special education teachers who take my workshops. And they're like, oh my gosh, this is so much better and easier. And I really wanted to know, but I couldn't ask. I felt like I would get in trouble.
That's so great. You're opening the door.
We have to reach across the aisle. If we want to make things better, it can't just be one person or another. We have to work together to make the process easier.
Yeah. No, I always say the same thing. Whatever family I'm working with, we need to be on the same page and know the path we're about to take. So do you sit down with parents during the IEP process and get the reports and the tests and be able to sit down and explain it to them if they don't understand it?
Yeah. So when families hire me as an advocate, we do things kind of differently. Is that first I do a complete record review, which is where I need to understand who I'm working with. And then we determine what is our action plan. Because if you're going to hire someone and invest in the time and the money, you need to map out what you're doing. And then it needs to be a good fit. Not every advocate is going to be the right fit, whether how they interact with the school or what their experience is. So you as a consumer need to hire someone that works for you. So once we decide it's a good fit and we work together, then let's say there's an evaluation coming up. I train the parent, have them take my courses, and we work together on, okay, how are you going to ask for the testing? What's the letter you're going to write? Then I show them about how the report works. We go through the training together. I coach them how to write a report, and I work on kind of guiding them through the process. There are many advocates out there who will do things for the family. That's fine. But if you're going to invest your time and money and you're in it for 10 years with an IEP, how is that helping you to not understand the process yourself? So I really feel like informing the parents and educating the parents will help them so that the next time they might not need to hire me and they can do this themselves. Because that's really what the parents want, is they want to do it themselves. They just don't have the tools. So we go through a training and a guidance and a coaching process instead of just, I do it for them.
Yeah, you want the parent to become a professional in the sense they need to have the knowledge. Do you find the parents that maybe you'll train them and they'll go off and maybe they'll come back and touch base with you? Do they do that?
Yeah, that's true. A lot of parents really enjoy having someone with them. And so I'll find many parents are like, this is great, but can I keep working with you? Because they want someone as a mentor. And they also are like, I'm in this by myself. I need someone who gets it. I need someone to kind of just give me that sense of community. Because many parents going through the process, we feel alone and we feel like no one understands. So I feel like that mentoring is a huge part where parents want to stay connected. And so I fully agree. I have many clients who are like, I've done this. I know how to do it myself, April, but like, can I still call you?
Hey, you know, I think it's really important to keep in touch with your mentors, you know, in order to go back and kind of review what you've been doing, what you've learned, make sure you're still on the right track. So to be able to have that access to you and you allow it, it's great. You know, I think that's mm-hmm. wonderful. You do workshops. Can you want to talk about your workshops a little bit?
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, Mark, I have do-it-yourself workshops where parents and teachers can take them at any time. They're available on demand. But then I also do group training. And so I'll train a parent organization. I trained a bunch of BCBAs. So perhaps there's an organization or a school out there. I do go to schools and provide trainings. So whoever wants to hire me, I go there and either do a customized training or one of my workshops, pretty much whatever area that you need, I work on.
Okay. You do in person and remote? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And you have a far reach across the country?
Yep.
You advertise inspirational moments. Would you be able to maybe share an inspirational moment that you've had?
Yeah. So I had a family that hired me, and they had worked with another advocate. And one of the conditions for the person hiring me said, you know what? I've been down this road before with someone else. And I hired someone and it kind of went sideways because the person I hired was a bulldog. And so they said, you know, I want someone that's going to make things easier at the meeting, that's going to tell me about the process, but that I will leave the meeting and not cry and not feel frustrated. And so we went to the meeting and it was in my hometown. So it made it really easy. I knew many, many of the people already because my kids had gone to that school. But we left the meeting and the parent was like, you know what? We got all the stuff done. It was easier. And I didn't cry after the meeting. And so they left the meeting. We were like, this is an easier experience. And they liked that the approach was better for them. And they felt like it was the right fit for their family. So again, it goes back to, even if you hire a professional who looks good on paper, not everyone is the right fit, just like not every teacher is the right fit for the child. And so having the right fit and then having the right work is great. Sometimes parents will reach out to me and they'll say, I want you to go to due process. I want you to do this. And I'll say, you know what? I'm not the right fit for you. You need to go find this and this and this person, because not everyone is going to be the right fit.
It's like finding a therapist or anything like that, a doctor, you know, making that connection is really important, that trust. Do you have a favorite part of your job that you love to do, or is it all of it?
My favorite part of my job, I love the feeling that parents have when they're able to do something that they couldn't do before. And then they come back and tell me, I felt so much better. I didn't cry. Things were better. And someone listened to me. And that feeling where they're almost like they couldn't believe it because they didn't know that they had it in their heart or their ability to do something. And then they came back and they're like, I was able to write that letter, or I was able to say, you know what? I like this instead, school. And that feeling of just being proud and feeling self-confident, that's why I do what I do. It's not to get at one person or another, but that feeling where the parents see and empower themselves, that's my favorite part of my job.
Yeah, the development stage, right? Watching growth in people and to be able to be a part of that. It's an amazing feeling, I agree. For parents who have maybe already had their IEP meeting, maybe, you know, they weren't certain about the outcome of it. Is there anything that you could give them as far as advice on how to follow up on the meeting and understanding that they don't have to sign the IEP until they're satisfied, things like that? Can you just kind of talk about that?
Yeah. So once the IEP is done, they need to, first of all, give you a copy. And the reason why I bring that up, Mark, is because unfortunately, and this happened to my client the other day, sometimes parents don't get a copy of the actual IEP for days or weeks, or they get part of it, but not was talked about. So I always recommend to families, when you're in person, especially at the meeting, is to say, okay, I want to leave this meeting with a copy of the IEP. And if they're like, no, 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 we're going to send it to you, you always send a follow-up letter. And so using a parent letter of attachment, you can document, here's what we talked about. Here's what we said. I'm looking forward to getting my documents. It's putting it in writing, what was talked about, and then also reminds the team, hey, I need this paperwork back. And then once you get the copy of the IEP, it's really important to look through it and to see if what was talked about is what's accurate. Also to check, make sure everything is correct, not just the child's name and the birth date, but is that what you guys talked about? And then if you're not, send an email. Okay, I'm not really clear on what was offered. I'd like this. And then as a parent, you have the right to say, I agree to the eligibility, or I disagree with this portion. You have the right to say, I'd like to reconvene. Let's talk about this more. I'm not clear. So you have the right to agree, disagree, or agree in parts. But the key is you want to make sure to get back to the school and just not sign. Because when you don't sign the IEP at all, what means is none of that went into process. So either you have nothing for your child or you have what was the last year, and then it gets really confusing and really gray. So you always want to communicate, but you have the right to ask questions and consent in parts.
When I was writing IEPs, we were always expected to have the IEP written prior to the meeting. I'm finding that it's a little different in some other situations, and I don't know if this is more universal now, where you go to the meeting and you discuss all the potential goals and things like that, and the IEP is developed after that. Is that really more the process? Because, and was I involved in a situation where the process was more the exception than the rule of having the IEP prepared before the meeting? Because the parents would have a copy going to the meeting and then be able to review it. Can you, do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is called draft. And so in different states, there's different rules, but in general, IDEA law talks about working together as a team to craft the plan. So I always train my parents and my teachers to promote the use of drafts. So when it comes to drafts, the misconception often is by the school districts, well, if we write it before, that predetermines placement, meaning that's telling the parent, here is what our offer is, which is against IDEA law. In reality, the drafts, the way it's supposed to work is, we all know this as when we're working in schools, you can't write the entire IEP from start to finish there. And so truly, to be able to write the IEP, you have to prepare a lot of the documents before. But in that same process, you want to share that with the family. So when we think about more working at the team, right, when I was a school psychologist, I always wanted the present levels from the special ed teacher. I always wanted to see the goals from the speech pathologist before, because we're working on it before, we're collaborating. We just tend to forget to include the parent. So when it comes to drafts, parents can request for a draft, and actually it saves time to write up the present levels before, write up the information page before, even propose goals, as long as we share that with the family. So providing drafts is okay as long as it's indicated on all the paperwork, this is a draft and it's only a draft, and that we don't offer the draft as the completed IEP, meaning we don't send the draft home. We're like, we're going to recommend resource 2 times a week. That's the part that you talk about at the meeting. So drafts are helpful. They save time as long as everyone includes the parent in the process of a draft. And then also make sure to talk about it at the meeting and work on it together as a team.
So I guess in a sense, you know, we did the draft, but the parents weren't involved in the draft until the draft was written. And then they were given the draft prior to the meeting to have an opportunity to go over it, but not necessarily be a part of the actual making of the draft.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that varies from state to state. So the parents in any state can request a draft. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. And if the team says no, the parents can say, well, actually, in order to meaningfully participate, I need to be able to preview the information, which is exactly the truth, because it's impossible for parents, doesn't matter if you're a doctor or a lawyer, to look at 40 pages in 20 minutes and be able to understand everything that's happening. So it actually saves time and money. And it also, as a teacher, I'm sure you'd understand, Mark, is that some teachers, when they come to the meeting, are fully prepared and others are not. And if you do a draft, then everyone has already put in the present levels. They put in their goals. And so actually it saves time for everybody and cuts down the meeting time usually by half.
Yeah. No, I think it makes sense because it does give you weeks and weeks to prepare, having considered and spoken with the team to kind of create these goals. So I think that's wise advice. This has been such a wonderfully inclusive conversation of the process. Is there anything that we've left out that you might want to speak to that I might not have asked you about?
No, I don't think so. I think you've covered it all, Mark.
So how can people connect with you? Where are you? Do you have your social media presence, your website, things like that?
Yeah. So if people want to reach me on my website, it's riseeducationaladvocacy.com. To sign up for a free consult, it's riseeducationaladvocacy.com/contact. And they can follow me on social media at Rise Ed Advocacy.
Okay. And I'll post all that stuff in the show notes. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Mark.
I want to thank you again for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me each week to hear about topics new to you or close to your heart. I hope this podcast might inspire you to face your days more confidently, stirring a greater sense of self-love, mindfulness, and outpouring of goodness and positive role modeling for your children, while remembering to attend to the areas of your own mental, physical, and if you're inclined, spiritual health, enabling you to be all you hope to be for them. All music heard on today's show comes from Jason Shaw at Audionautix.com. Remember to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Special Ed Rising, and on my website, specialedrising.com. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends. You can contact me directly with questions, comments, or if you're interested in parent training through my email, specialedrising@gmail.com, or my contact pages on Facebook or my website. Also, let me know if there's anything you'd like to learn more about, and until next time, peace and keep rising.